Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Professor Frans van der Riep, world-renowned visionary thought leader and innovating entrepreneur. Frans, thank you for coming in today and sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
You're welcome.
Frans, you wrote a most interesting article, just really simply amazing. Can you distill some of the key elements of the article, but update it to 2013?
You're pointing at my essay on Back to the Middle Ages, I think. It's my metaphor to understand better the time we live in. One of my observations is that as context changes because of technology, many people do not understand what they see. And as context drives meaning, you need a metaphor for context to better understand what you see. And from this metaphor of the Middle Ages, not in a scientific manner, but just in a metaphoric sense, I'm not an historian, I try to that people understand better what they see. And to give you some properties of the Middle Ages, which I think quite relevant for our time. In Middle Ages, people were responsible for their own safety. There was no police guarding you. In the Middle Ages, you have the guilds, the groups of professionals, which come back nowadays, just another name. In the Middle Ages, people had their own structures to live on. There were no collective structures. Well, we see the same thing coming back. I think, for example, that the big energy companies, the big banks, that type of business models, well, in 10, 20 years, we don't have them anymore, because we don't need them anymore. In the Middle Ages, we had the city-state, we had the crusades, we had the marching, we had the robbering knights. Well, we have them. We call them now CEOs with big bonuses. It's more or less the same. There are lots of parallels, and those parallels, and that's my intention, allow us to better understand what world we live in. And if you understand what you see, that helps you, and that helps the quality of your action. If you don't understand what you see, that paralyzes you. You don't do anything because you don't know what to do. So that's where my story comes in. Does it make sense for you?
Yes, absolutely. I can see many of the parallels as you've indicated.
Well, it's also about, for example, the concept of companies changing. Well, we think about companies as something which without an end. The companies are immortal. Well, and as I envision it, we're on track to change the concept of company into projects. So temporary coalitions of super temps who make something together and have a temporary cooperation. After that, they find their own way. Like movies are being produced. I also think, for example, that the insurance companies will go back to groups of people organizing their own insurance, their own safety. We have that in the Netherlands. We go back to barter. Look at what's happening in Greece. Lots of Greece people survive by bartering. Well, that's medieval. Well, indeed, lots of parallels which would help, I hope, help you and me to understand the what process we are.
It's a fascinating concept, and as you indicated, we're seeing some of these kind of parallels. How do you see governments evolving?
Oh, I'm very sure the concept of state-nation will change. I'm not sure I will be there anymore as a human being, but the long-term processes. But there is no business case for example, the state of the Netherlands. And there are, for example, studies from MIT. They come up with five scenarios how it might be in 30, 40 years from now. One of those scenarios is, for example, the city-state, like Venice in the 12th, 13th century. For example, the Dutch Randstad, that's the western part of our country, may be a new nation. I don't know, but that something will change and that democracy will change for example, because of social media, that each person can raise his voice if he wants to and can regain power. I'm very sure of that. But whether it will be Europe or whether it will be Neuronomics, I don't know, but there will be, there will change something, and I'm very sure of that. But there are many options open.
What about changes with companies? Where do you see that evolving?
What I envision, and then I speak as a researcher, not as a businessman. What I envision is that we go two ways. One of them is where we go back to creating and maintaining some basic social infrastructures. Of course, we have water, we have dikes, we have, toilets and that type of thing. We have, and the new one in this area will be ICT. I think ICT is so important and we're so much dependent on it that ICT infrastructure should be seen as a basic social infrastructure. If you do not have access on the internet, you have a problem. That's one part, and I think that will be ruled more publicly, not by the market, more publicly than is the case now, because it's so important. The other direction is that in this infrastructure, companies will become much smaller than they are now and will use these infrastructures as temporary projects. And they will make use, they will use those public infrastructures. That's basically how I envision, say, developments 10 years from now. And if you look at my part of the world, Western Europe, which is not that different from Canada, you already can see these developments nowadays. China and Japan, that's a different story. They're much more top-down.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned China and Japan or parts of Asia being quite different. And do you see them evolving at some point and maybe becoming more like a Singapore?
I think China, especially China, is much more on upscaling. Their agenda is upscaling, and their agenda is not making things more flexible and as we are doing now in the Netherlands and this part of the world. They're more in the industry type of development, and they have more the scalability and the pricing questions, and we are more here in the innovation question.
Interesting. I've been speaking at various world events, at the World Congress, at the World Economic Forum, and one of the sort of really exciting areas that I've heard a lot about is this massively open online courses or MOOCs and how that's going to shape education. But that's just one area, social media and its impact, that's also shaping education. From your point of view, what will education look like in 2015?
First of all, I'm not so much so sure whether social media really opens the world for especially young people. Also on this point, you can have more viewpoints. What happens here is 70 to 80% of the people using smartphones or mobile data, they basically use their mobile phone, their smartphone, to bring their own home with them. So what they do is not open their world, but what they do is stay in the bubble. They take their home with them. So first of all, we should really understand whether social media really open the world and whether that's really happening. I'm not so sure of that. So, the second part of your question is whether what's the impact of social media on ICT? Well, I'm very sure that some ICT skills should be integrated in education from a very young age, like arithmetic and reading, and it's basic. Second, the way new materials are being channeled to students, like see what's happening for various universities in the United States. I think we will have a two-speed education. So basic material can be transmitted to you and me as a student by the internet, by means of video or whatever. And the rest of it may be a dialogue with a human being. And I think lots of basic skills may be channeled to you and me, not by a book or by an ebook even, but by just a video explaining how things work. The other thing is really the part of taking position as a human being towards knowledge. So the academic part, where say 5 to 10% of us all so well. Well, that should be shaped like a dialogue. And I think teachers should be much more able to have a dialogue with students than say 10, 15 years ago. And I'm sure this is quite a rapid development. That's not 20 years ago. That's happening now.
And then extending this question even further, and you've already talked about this somewhat already, about infrastructure, in fact, ICT infrastructure, and how that maybe become more of a public utility. So how do you see ICT infrastructure evolving into the future?
Well, ICT is it's about your ability to electronically exchange information. I think that be more and more a commodity, and with lots of standardization, that make it as cheap as possible. That's the technological part. On the other hand, if you really look upon ICT and access to internet as a basic feature, well, governments should guarantee people this access. That's the other part. And for example, in the Netherlands, the government might give each citizen in the Netherlands an email address, an internet access, whatever. It might happen.
Do you see any controversy with regards to internet access? I know in Dubai, the ITU had that summit, and there's a number of countries that wanted to put some sort of maybe stronger governmental regulation or maybe some control over it. And then there was the opposing argument of maybe keeping it multi-stakeholder like the way it is today. Do you have any views on that?
I don't think the government should interfere in the contents as long as it is within the law. And then I have in my mind a Canadian or US or Dutch kind of law, and it should not interfere in contents. And with respect to this access, I look at it then from the infrastructure point of things. So the canals, like roads, like dikes, it's just another infrastructure.
Franz, you're one of the world's most notable thought leaders and thinkers, and for many years have laid predictions which have come true, and in fact are highly respected as global authority. And as a result, I think you're sort of very well positioned to answer this question, and that is, what do you see as the top challenges faced by enterprises and governments today?
Then you always come to human features. So I think HR, human resource management, is the key thing in each company. And you should go back to the question, why a company exists. Well, as I see it, the company exists because it can produce cooperation cheaper than the market is able to. If you don't meet that requirement, there is no reason for it to exist for a company. That puts cooperation as cheap as possible at the agenda. And that's, of course, a technological thing. But it's also about human challenges, about being able as a company to have the talent to see talent, have to have the ability to put the right person at the right place. So if you have a job in a company and you know of a colleague who is better equipped to do the same job, you should step back. Cooperation is the core competence of the future. Well, the other challenge is, each one of us, including companies, they have A, B, and C's on the personal record. And one of the things is that you really, as a company, have to accept and to understand where your A's are, and you have to act with focus on where you're very good at. You really should understand your core competence. And if you don't accept your core competence, well, your competitors on the market will put you down. The customers will put you down. So I think those are the two basic challenges for companies. What is my core competence? What is it now? And what do I need to stay on the market? And number two, what can I do to make cooperation cheaper? And that brings in practice, for example, the question, how do I get grip on not only encoded information, but also the tested information? How do I bring all tested information to the business that makes one cheaper and more effective? And how do I find people who are able to the kind of cooperation I need as a company to be profitable and to make I really cooperate, I make myself dependent on you. And feeling dependent is something which lots of Western people have issues with. But we have to learn that. Otherwise, we're out of business.
And then you talked about the enterprise, and how do you see this sort of impacting government again?
Well, the government should, enterprise will be more and more volatile. The flexibility is new continuity. Enterprises should create the stability and the formal backgrounds, the formal structures in which you can cooperate. They should create a safe place, for example. They should create infrastructure for which in which I can work as a company. That's how I look at it. And companies, they should not only focus on cooperation in the company, but they should also focus on cooperation between companies. New combinations and what Peter Tsenji called presencing, new combinations, that's where the money is. So you don't only look at your own company and cooperation within your own company. Look broader. There are lots of new combinations out there. That's where the money is.
And then I guess from a government standpoint, you've sort of expressed some thoughts about the communications state and political legitimization and the fact that civil justice and e-readiness and the speed of decision-making process, all of these are sort of challenges, including evolving technology in relation to legislation itself.
Oh, they're very big challenges. This morning I had a visit in our Ministry of Social Affairs, and one of the problems is that the whole government is more or less institutionalized on slow processes and lots of time for decision-making. Well, that's not how it is. So the whole institutional background for the government is put under pressure by social media. That's a big problem. What I know from research is that the adoption of real innovation, so the very big innovation from candle to electricity or from horses to cars, that type of disruptive innovation, it takes 50 years to really adopt. 50 years, so two generations. And from those two generations we need for the internet, which is another disruptive innovation. We've just had 15 years, so most has to come. And it's very it's very clear that social media and like Twitter, Yammer, and they put democracy under pressure. It's happening before our eyes, and as far as I know, no one knows the solution. It's just happening, and it will take a lot of time to find new balance there. And that, as I see it, the innovation that has the same stature, much say, as the internet, that it was the entire conception in the early 60s. Well, you remember, I think. And we have 50 years ahead from there, and there's still a lot of people discussing whether that's good or bad. Well, then with the internet, we'll have the same, and each person will be forced to have to find a personal position on this. That's all what happens. That's always what happens with big innovation.
So we talked about the major challenges impacting enterprises and governments, and how that's going to sort of involve or influence people in essence as well. What do you see as some of the top opportunities with regards to enterprises and governments, because the world is changing so fast?
Well, I think we have a big opportunity to, as far as I think that's important, to make the world more human. Internet leads us into the personal age. Internet makes it possible that you live your life and that you shape your life as you want to be it. That's a big opportunity. So internet makes it possible to leave this tailor type of company, where the company structure gives you the position of nuts and bolts in an anonymous structure which you cannot influence. Internet gives us the opportunity to create new matching principles where you don't get your work from your boss, but that you create your own work, that you become your own entrepreneur, whether you're in a company or self-employed, doesn't matter. I give you an example here. I did a job with our bus and tram company here. They have around 5,000 people, and they drive here in Rotterdam, where I live, buses and trams. And all those people driving buses and trams, they have a schedule. And 10 years ago, they got their schedule from a planning department, and they just had to obey their schedule. It's schedule push. Nothing wrong with that. But what they do now is, and it's driven by technology, each person there, they get a list of possible movements, trams and bus, and they can pick their own rides. So they can create their own work. Of course, not totally free, and some night drives which are not that popular, perhaps you have to instruct people. But they can basically create and assemble their own work. People laugh at that. And the company has, from this, has established about 30% cost reduction. And most people there are much more happy because they can shape their own working life. What that type of thing you could do. And the internet creates personal age. And most of us will benefit from that.
Franz, because of your stature and the research that you do, you have a regional, national, and global point of view. And I'd like to get your thoughts on what you see as the opportunities for national economies.
Well, then, I think neuronomics is a big theme. I call that the circle, reestablishing circle of life. I think internet makes it possible to have more influence on your life. You shape more your own life, and you're not that much ruled by factors, by others you can't influence. Well, that also means that Europe or the Netherlands have the opportunity, to much more than 20 years ago, to focus on what they are good at and to just to go that direction and not just to adapt to an anonymous structure. That's an opportunity. And we have lots of discussion here also in the Netherlands. What is now the assets, the basic assets of Dutch economy? And of course you have to make a choice and to really choose what you think your big innovation would be. But internet allows us to do that much more than 10, 20 years ago. And in this region, we're in the process of doing that. That's right.
I guess in some of your writings and also in your thinking, you've expressed this idea of economy without growth or the importance of infrastructure, just the pervasiveness of education and, you know, the fact that it's multiple access points and this whole idea of a creative economy and, you know, this new global power division and international politics, all of this sort of impacting in some way of national economies. Do you have any further thoughts on those ideas?
I have some thought, but I have no idea how things will develop. There are so many possibilities. We have the European perspective, that Europe will be the sense of belonging, and it will be really Europeans, and that we have to do the discussion on that level in Brussels. We have the neuronomics idea. For example, I know that in any of the 40-50 regions where people have local money and local currency, you've seen about 15% economic boost. That's another. Everything is open. I think that's the basic thing. Internet allows us to redo, to re-answer many, many questions. I think that's the big opportunity, an opportunity to redo. Lots of industries will vanish. I think, for example, that I said before, the banking model, the insurance model, that's all obsolete. I think we, in maybe that in sometimes we will skip the, for example, the legal entity, because we had the legal entity limited, or in Germany the company limited responsibility. We had all of that to make financing possible. But in these days of crowdfunding, crowdsourcing, we don't need that anymore. If you look at the United States, the number percentage of corporate financing by crowdfunding, it's enormous. It's grown enormously. Well, if you would skip legal entity, well, then you come to very interesting scenarios how things could be. And one of the things is that if people are really responsible what they do, like the names of the Lights of London, they're personally responsible for their investment. my high hope is we will go that direction.
Franz, you've done a lot of research over a number of years, and you've been recognized on a world basis because of that outstanding work that you've done. Can you then share some of the results from your extensive research?
I tell them in more broad anthropological terms, not in technological. One of them is context drives meaning. That means for a company to have meaning, it should be very conscious about the context of the company. It sounds a little bit general, I know, but most companies are not aware of their social impact and have problems with their meaning. Well, and then you can spend a lot of money about marketing, but in the end, you still don't have meaning. So you have to manage context, and you have to manage branding, and branding comes more and more important. Second thing is we go from lean and mean to lean and meaningful. Meaning, having meaningful work, having meaningful job is one of the big magnets for social cohesion and for cooperation, and makes cooperation much cheaper. So that's a very big thing to create continuity for the company. Well, another one is the end of ERP. What we did, and I think that's a big mistake, we started to use ERP systems in the early 90s to match people. And, well, ERP, it comes from MRP, Managed Resource Planning, and they are meant to match material things, not people. If you make scheduling and cooperation a spreadsheet thing by using ERP systems, you treat people as like nuts and bolts, and that doesn't work. Well, Charlie Chaplin already knew that in his movie Modern Times, so it's not that new. But we're now in the process of skipping ERP systems to structure cooperation and to make cooperation really a personal decision again. And I think that's a big thing. Well, another thing is that we go back from ERP type of cooperation to barter, and with the internet in the end you discover your neighbor. That's what's happening. And we have lots of companies here with that use that insight. For example, we have big care institutions with big planning departments using ERP to do the matching of the caretakers to patients and clients. But we also have a small company which just with circles of, say, at maximum 20 professional people in caretaking, they do exactly the same job without management, without ICT, without overhead, and they are about 40% cheaper. And patients love them because it's always the same person who's taking care of you, and the patient is not a order, a work order, like in the EP world, but is a human being again. And that's where the profit is a bit difficult word, but that's where the value is. And yeah, on the other hand, for example, I love this thinking about how things might be. We will not make any money about scenarios, but the value of this is, I hope it sharpens the mind and it gives some clue where the possible scenarios are. And as a professor, it's very nice to do speeches on that.
Franz, you've done so much and you've contributed so much to the world thinking and many, many domains. And you've held other, very successful roles and throughout your remarkable history. So from your prior roles, do you have any lessons or best practices that you can share?
Well, as I'm almost 6 years old now, and what I've learned from this is it might sound very simple, but what I've learned is keep things simple. Make it as simple as possible. Simple is difficult enough. What I've learned is avoid transgressions. And I mean, the transgression is if you feel something is not okay, then just don't go there. And if you feel you should say that, although you need some courage to, then stand up and say it. What I've learned is be clear in your intentions. And be very clear, and life is short, so don't waste your time. Be clear in your intentions. And what I'm learning now is combine the insights from economics, technology, but also from anthropology and psychology. In the end, our difficulties, which we have to understand, are in nature always human. Technological problems don't exist. It's always about humans. And especially anthropologists and psychologists help me enormously with their frames of reference, with their ways of looking at people. They help me enormously to understand what I see. And in times of changing context, I feel that that's very valuable. And in terms of innovation, well, what I've learned from innovation is the biggest lesson for me is stop innovation, stop an initiative when it loses momentum. Innovation capacity in a company is usually very expensive. And at the moment you feel it will not be a success, then you have the responsibility to stop the thing and to focus on initiatives which still might be a success. I think you should be careful in using the word innovation, because most things we call them innovation are not innovation. They are just first use. So the first time you use a technology, for example, going from Windows 7 to Windows 8, that's not an innovation, first use. And the first use problem is a management problem. And innovation is a leadership problem. That's another thing. Well, and in terms of accepting new business and accepting entrepreneurship, is if someone comes to me with an idea, a concept, business plan, or whatever, I basically have three questions. And the first question is always, does he or she, usually are he's, but sorry for that, but does he understand what he wants? Well, that's about 50%, which I lose then. Someone really understand what you want, that's a basic for success. And if someone needs a whole roman, a whole text, or 5 minutes to explain, it won't be a success. The second thing is, do I see the person as someone who is going to succeed? Is he capable to do it? Well, that leaves us with 2 or 3%. And the third question I have on entrepreneurship then is, well, your plan, is it scalable? Can it grow? Because everything that doesn't grow won't survive. So those three questions. And with respect to innovation, I already said to you, well, don't make things bigger, and first use is first use, and innovation is innovation. But there are three in the dynamics of innovation, three steps I always use. Step one is, well, an innovation should solve a concrete problem, not fake, but concrete problem. That's step one. So you should be aware of what problem you're solving. And if there's no problem, there won't be an innovation. For example, contactless payment in this region, I'm not talking about Africa, that's different, but contactless payment in this region doesn't solve a problem. So I don't think it won't be a success. Step two is about innovation, is hide complexity. It makes things easier. It's a window screen before all type of algorithm. And step three of innovation is do new applications with new technology. And the lesson is don't start with step three because it doesn't work. If you start in your innovation with step three, do new applications with new technology, then you ask your user to adapt on two things at one time, the new application and the new technology. And your user won't do that. The step is too big. So always start with step one, solve a concrete problem. Well, I think I can give you as a wisdom from me.
Franz, just an amazing series of sort of insights in terms of innovation that you shared with us. The audience would also want to know the kinds of resources that you would use, especially with your tremendous background and history of success.
Well, where I get my information, I often just don't know, to be honest with you. What I do is I talk a lot with various people from various domains. So I go to doctors and ask how they do it. I go to captains in industry. I'm in more networks. I'm within the business. I'm within the research. And I have some non-executive board memberships. So I have the opportunity to talk with lots of people. And I think that's my basic resource. I don't read. So I don't read Harvard Business Review. I don't read Gartner. And I don't read Forrester because I don't really get any information from that. I get the information from people I speak. And what I always try, what for me is very important, is what philosophy calls consilience. Consilience is your ability to deploy a pattern in domain A, which you can see in domain A, to domain B. For example, if you have the laws in physics about how liquids flow, and you can use those laws to calculate traffic jams. That's consilience. And consilience is that's the concept, and I use very much. I try to understand what can I learn in domain B from domain A, and I always try to ask that questions to myself and to others, and that's where I get my information. And in terms of human positioning, well, I think it's very important in life to always be both teacher and pupil. If you always in any circumstance feel the teacher, you don't learn anything because you're the teacher. So you should also always allow yourself to be teacher and pupil. Second, I think especially for people leading us, the boardroom people, you should be not only talk to your friends, but you should also talk to your enemies, unquote, in order to organize your own critics. Don't talk only with friends. Also talk with adversaries, because there you learn something. And your adversaries will help you to get out of your tunnel. Because if you're in your tunnel, you don't learn anything. And third quote I would like to make is, for the business, well, pay for performance and promote for ability. So don't promote for performance what is usually being done. But that doesn't work here. Performance is about the past, and ability is about the future. So you should never promote for performance. You should promote for ability. So in our databases, especially in our big companies, I should not only find what someone has done in the past, and his jobs, and a list of a record of what has been achieved, but I would also like to find what someone's abilities are, or what his colleague thinks his abilities are. So that's lots of earning power can be created there. Well, I think also from a human standpoint, how you are in life is always accept there are multiple viewpoints, there are multiple belief systems, and accept how obvious it is, but accept that people have different characters and they have different personal needs. It will help you enormously. Don't put people in your structure. It doesn't help, and it's also not very honest to do that. Accept people are different. I know it sounds trivial, but in practice it's sometimes quite a challenge. Well, the last thing I do is really advise read the great actors. Read the great authors like, for me, Handy, the Bono, I think those type of authors, you can learn quite a lot, and they help you to create context. They help you in your mind to create a taxonomy that you have a much better way, much better equipped to really observe what you see and to really understand what you see.
As one of the world's foremost experts and thought leaders, you must get into areas of controversy. So can you describe a few areas of controversy in the areas that you work?
I have, because I'm a game changer. So that many consider my viewpoints as provocative and yes, even not relevant. And my position there is, well, I tell what I think and what I feel, and whether the world accepts that, that's not my problem. That's my basic attitude in this. For example, in the early 90s, I had a debate about the earpiece systems, and lots of companies made lots of profit about that. And I said to you, yeah, well, it's you derive people from their souls, and you derive the company from their psychology. And it's each psychologist can explain that it's not possible to code all information you need to really shape cooperation. Well, and not all people like that. Well, and I basically don't see that's my problem. And another controversy, one of my statements is, well, especially because of the internet, customer in, overhead out. And financial management is sometimes really addicted to problems, as these problems are the bread and butter. And what I state then, that each business problem, and each problem, each business problem, can be solved within 3 months. And if longer than 3 months, then you can be sure someone benefits from the problem. Well, and now lots of people out there don't like that statement. Well, that 3 months is then I really refer to people, to business type of problem. I don't refer to people with terminal cancer or something like that, because they have a real problem. And yeah, that's if you're a game changer, and if you discuss contacts, then you should be aware, and you should be that sometimes someone doesn't like your work. Well, that's part of the game.
And that's a fascinating idea that, as you've indicated, management can be addicted to their problems, and if it can't be solved within a relatively short period of time, then someone benefits from the problem. Very, very interesting. We're down to our last three questions here, and this is a bit of a shift in the questioning, in that it's about computing. And so I want to get your feeling about computing being a recognized profession on par with accounting, medicine, and law, engineering, with demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics, computing professionals taking personal responsibility, having public accountability for their work, some level of quality assurance for their work, and recognized credentials, again, like in the other professions. What are some of your viewpoints on that?
Well, good point. I think the best quality management is peer-to-peer review. In the end, you never can force professionalism by ruling. It doesn't work, peer-to-peer review. I really know sometimes it doesn't work, but I think that's been your a compliment for your peers, from your peers, is very, very stimulating, very motivating. But, as I understand your question, I think computing is too important to leave to the ICT community. It also, this one, it should be looked upon from various angles. For example, of course, we need doctors to cure us, but we need ourselves to live healthy. So, of course, the computing community should be professional, should adapt integrity, should be professional in behavior, should not lie, should not come up with solutions that are not solutions, that type of thing. But that's one part of the pie. The other one is that we also need personal responsibility in this, and we also need people that are literate and that understand the basic needs from the computing community. I think the problem is too big to just the computing thing and being dependent on that, and just the computing tribe, and we should define the problem much broader than that. And, well, a code of conduct, a code of ethics, as a sign, well, you're dealing with the real world, and please understand what you do has a material impact. I think that's a good idea.
Franz, you've traveled extensively. You've spoken around the world. Your work has shaped government and industry, business and academia, media, society, and so on, because of just the nature of your thought leadership. From all of that work that you've done worldwide and in your region, are there any stories that you can share? Maybe something amusing, surprising, unexpected, or maybe?
Yeah. I'll give you two, and I'm a little bit laughing here. Well, one of the stories I sometimes tell to my audience is that I ask her, well, you're now standing on Cape Town, on the Cape, and you're looking south. And then I ask them, what is the first country you arrive at when you just go south, you pass Antarctic, you go further than that, and where are you heading to? Where do you come when you go straight south from Cape Town after having passed the Antarctic? Well, and then you have a broad audience with very intelligent, smart people and all big careers and whatever. And I have this trick now for some 20 years. And in all those time, perhaps two people well, do you know, this is basic, this is knowledge from a 10-year-old boy or girl. And then you try a little bit to embarrass them. I agree, I like that. But the second story is maybe 5-6 years ago, and I had a talk for 20, well, very senior people, so put a degree of responsibility, and I asked them, as I always start a talk or a conversation, I asked them, well, what is what you want from me? And, big silence on the other half, the 20 important people, big silence. So they're obviously not prepared. So, and then I said, and I don't know where it came from, very deep down in my system. Then I said to them, well, this is exactly the passive consuming way of listening. You always say this to students nowadays, you should stop and you do it yourself. Well, deep silence. Well, I think that's what my most effective 3-minute speech. And I will talk about it.
We're now down to our last question, and I'm going to turn the tables in this interview in that if you were conducting this interview, what one or more questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
I think you already asked me a lot of questions. And, why do I do what I do? What drives me? And, to give you the answer, what drives me is try to what I have learned, make it available to the next generation. And I think how do I want to be remembered? Perhaps a good question. Well, I think in deep down, basically, I'm a teacher. I want to be remembered as a wise teacher. I think that I do.
Well, you definitely are impacting the world and the next generation. You are definitely a guide to the new world and for many, many generations to come. And you've had a remarkable journey, and you continue to contribute in such an amazing way to the world. So I know your schedule is demanding, and thank you for coming in and sharing your experiences with your audience.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
I'm Steve Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Professor Frans van der Riep, world-renowned visionary thought leader and innovating entrepreneur.